available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Hello and welcome from me, Nigel Hewin, to this week's edition of Outlook, being recorded on Wednesday the 1st of May 2024. And in this edition, Elaine will be visiting Aston Cantlow. We'll complete our story with Keith on the Pink Panther. We've got a bit more from Susie Dent's Dictionary Corner. Bill concludes his story about TikTok, if you're any the wiser, as I am not. And then we go on to something much simpler, hospital food, a little story by Ali. And then we're going to complete the programme with a report on a holiday in Wales by David and Hen Graham. But before all that, of course, we have got your postbag, sport, news from the centre. But as ever, we're going to start with the news with our readers, Elaine and Peter.
Outlook News.
Pop producer Pete Waterman and a team of fellow rail enthusiasts have broken a record after building the world's biggest mobile model railway. Coventry-born Pete Waterman and the Rail Nuts team built a model with nearly 1 kilometre, 3,280 feet, of track at the NEC in Birmingham. The railway, which depicts the West Coast Main Line in detail between Rugby and Watford Junction, was displayed at the Model World Live event. At 999.9 metres of track, we are the longest portable model railway in the world, said Pete, adding the response to the record had been beyond our wildest dreams. I'm proud for the lads who built it. We're a team. It's not just me. We set out to do it and we've done it. It's fantastic, he said. The 208 foot by 14 foot, or 63 metres by 4 metres, scale layout incorporates tracks they built over recent years for display at Chester Cathedral. It also features a 4-track main line and the option to pass trains at Milton Keynes Central. Pete said, the Guinness Book of Records adjudicators had spent 7.5 hours checking it. That was stressful, I promise you, he said. The rules are very strict, and it has to be measured to within 500 millimetres. So it has to be professionally built, it has to run, and all the tracks that are counted have to carry trains. When Guinness Book of Records announced they had certified it, the place went crazy. People were cheering and shouting. It was fantastic, Waterman said. He added they had received an enthusiastic response afterwards, both nationally and around the world, including he received calls at midnight from the US. He added the model railway would return to Chester Cathedral in August, and the team intended to return to the NEC next year and had its sights set on what it could achieve in 2025. There are more records to be set, he said, adding, but we can't go any bigger.
A Warwickshire pub that had flooded 11 times in less than a year has thanked customers for their support since their reopening. The Royal Oak in Brandon, which we've spoken about before, was closed for 4 months after Storm Henk hit it in January, swamping the pub with brown-coloured water. Owner Cara Shrivers said that around £180,000 had been spent on works, including repairing damaged roofs, burst water pipes, cracked floors and more. She added that while she had questioned at one point whether it was viable to continue with the pub, they were extremely happy to be able to reopen. We are so appreciative of the local community and of all our customer base, she added. To make up for lost revenue, the pub has increased its opening hours in the hope of attracting more business, and the Royal Oak has installed custom-made floodgates to prevent water from coming into the building in the future.
Thousands have been raised as the stars of BBC The Apprentice headed to Coventry. Paul Mitter, Virgie Mazaria, Raj Chohan and Phil Turner took part in a fundraising event at Finham Park School. Hosted by Coventry Bangla classes, the fun-filled event saw hundreds of people dancing to raise much-needed funds for Cancer Research UK. Organiser Aman Singh said the hugely popular event marked the largest ever Bangla class held in the United Kingdom. Dr. Paul Mitter, who was featured on The Apprentice, said it was a pleasant surprise to see people of all ages get their dancing shoes on last Thursday, April the 25th. He went on to describe the event as absolutely incredible. Verdi, who also featured on The Apprentice, said being able to combine his love of dancing with raising funds for Cancer Research UK was amazing. Bangra is massive to me, and to integrate that for a great cause like cancer research is amazing. So it's a win-win situation. I can see different ethnicities coming down here to do Bangra, and I think it is amazing. Raj from Leamington Spa said, "It is an honour for us to have you guys receive us so well, and thank you so much for putting this all towards Cancer Research UK. It is really close to my heart. I have lost a few family members, and we have had a few diagnoses as well. So it really is special. And thank you to everyone for digging in deep." Paul said he was shocked by the huge crowds that had turned up, saying, "It has been absolutely incredible, and the fact that everyone is joining in for the right cause is just amazing to see. Around £2,000 was raised for Cancer Research UK. Organiser Aman Singh told Coventry Live that he was extremely grateful to those who attended, saying it demonstrates the spirit of generosity, community and inclusivity that defines our cause.
A campaign group will step up its bid to publicise the availability of public toilets in Coventry city centre. Members of Need the Loo were out in the Broadgate area on Monday, April the 29th, to place guerrilla signage directing visitors to public conveniences. They say they are responding to the absence of sufficient signage provided by the council, and that toilets in the city generally are inadequate. A survey by the group found that 55% of respondents avoided using public toilets, and a quarter limited their time shopping in the city centre in order to get home to their own facilities more quickly. A spokesman for the group said, "Being able to use clean, accessible public toilets, often urgently, is an issue of dignity and safety affecting disabled people, people with long-term health conditions, older people, parents with small children, and many more. The issue may not directly affect everyone right now, but it well could at some point in their lives. We were motivated to act after hearing many different experiences from people who need to access toilets easily and without fuss, but are struggling to do so in Coventry city centre. The group acknowledges that some support has come from the council's public health department, including the provision online of an accessible map of toilets, and that £450 million is being spent on developing Coventry City South, which may improve matters. But members of Need the Loo say that better and more signage is needed, maintenance should be improved, and provision is lacking anyway in some areas of the city centre. They would like businesses and tourist attractions to make their toilets available for easy public use." A Coventry City Council spokesperson said, "Coventry fares well compared to lots of other towns and cities where there are few or no public toilets at all. There are a number of toilets in our city centre, in shopping centres, shops and restaurants, attractions and council-run toilets in the library. And with pressure on budgets, it is right that the provision of toilets is a joint effort. The council toilets in the library are open every day during working hours, and the new changing places facility at the railway station is open until the last train leaves in the late evening. All of the new wayfinding maps include the location of the nearest toilets. So we hope that no one should struggle to locate where the nearest toilets are.
A plumber who once applied unsuccessfully for over 500 jobs now has a hand in running a successful Coventry business. Daniel Hayes got his break after a local newspaper ran a story about his tough luck in the job market, and Kieran Masterson, then running a one-man band, took him on. Now business partners at New Age Heating and Interiors, the pair employ 13 staff, including 7 engineers and 5 apprentices, and have just celebrated a move to a new premises. The company, which also offers heating services, has switched from a base in Earlston to a over 1,000 square foot unit at Kingswood Close Industrial Estate in Holbrooks. It was established in 2019, and bosses hope the move will usher in a period of growth. Following New Age's arrival, all 10 units at the industrial estate are occupied. It has also invested a 5-figure sum in fitting out the property to create office space and a mezzanine floor for storage. Daniel said, "We have taken enough space to be able to grow over the next few years, and we're really pleased with the location." The company was started by Kieran in 2019, and then I joined 3 years ago, having worked in London. We are really keen to bring through the next generation, which is why we have 5 apprentices. I started as an apprentice myself. I'd actually applied for over 500 jobs back in 2010 and couldn't find one. The local paper ran a story on me and Kieran took me on. Giving me that chance back then means I can do the same for others now. The new premises are owned by Coventry City Council. Councillor Jim O'Boyle said, "It's great that all of our units at Kingswood Close are fully let, and it's lovely to hear such a local success story."
Mighton Hospice has praised the unwavering dedication and support of a 91-year-old volunteer who has raised hundreds of thousands of pounds through bucket collections. Margaret Kite has collected £31,366 in aid of the Mighton Hospices in just the past year, through 218 collections in supermarkets and other locations. The hospice said Miss Kite from Kenilworth was one of the area's most devoted collection volunteers, whose fundraising spanned 3 decades. A spokesperson described her as a superstar and a true inspiration to others. Miss Kite visited Buckingham Palace for a garden party in 2017 after being awarded a British Empire Medal for her services to the local community. She has previously worked for St John's Ambulance and also collected on behalf of Marie Curie and the Royal British Legion. Mighton Hospice, which runs sites in Coventry, Rugby and Warwick, said it needed to raise £11 million this year to continue providing services free of charge. A charity spokesperson thanked all those who had contributed to Miss Kite's collections over the years. "Your support means the world to us, our patients and their families," they added.
And we hear of another kind-hearted Coventry woman who has retired after years of dedicating her life to helping those in need. Bev Spencer has spent more than 50 years working for the NHS in Coventry and Warwickshire. Bev spent decades working as a sister on the short-stay acute medicine unit at UHCW. She has worked in that role since the trust was formed in 1992. After nearly 52 years of commitment to the NHS in Coventry and Warwickshire, Bev completed her final shift on Saturday, April the 27th. Colleagues shared memories of time spent together and described working with the mum of two as an absolute pleasure. Bev said she will miss the people that she has worked with over the years. "I will miss them most, and the send-off they have given me has been overwhelming." She's looking forward to quality time with her family, saying, "I would like to get a little dog and maybe travel a little, but mainly I just want to enjoy being with the children and grandchildren." A spokesperson for the University Hospitals Coventry and Warwickshire Trust said, "All here send Bev our best wishes and thanks for her loyalty and dedication. She will be greatly missed." Colleagues heaped well wishes on Bev. Lynn Clark commented, "Great memories of our time at Coventry and Warwick and the laughs we had." And Amanda Twynham said, "You have worked hard all your career and you deserve a lot of fun and family time."
Hundreds of people participated in last Sunday's Coventry Half Marathon, which began on Gosford Street and finished at Coventry Cathedral. Despite the torrential rain that carried on throughout the morning, there was a celebratory atmosphere with spectators lining the streets to cheer on runners of all ages and abilities. The route started in the heart of the city centre before heading out to the countryside and towards Warwickshire before the participants made their way back to the city centre for the finish line. Runners could enjoy entertainment from local music groups, including the Impact Steel Band, Coventry Pride, Voice of the Town and the Rock Choir. In the men's race, Alistair MacDonald triumphed in a time of 1 hour 13 minutes and 8 seconds, while Amanda Devey was the first female to finish in an impressive time of 1 hour 28 minutes and 24 seconds. However, the real winners from the event are the local charities, who will benefit from the efforts of the many people who took part for good causes, raising tens of thousands of pounds to make a real difference. Partner charities for the event include Zoe's Place, Mighton Hospice, RSPCA Coventry and District Mind Coventry in Warwickshire, plus the Jane Tomlinson Appeal. Entries are now open for the 2025 Coventry Half Marathon, which will be staged on the 7th of April 2025. Potential participants can go to www.runforall.com for a limited time only discounted offer.
A man has been reunited with his beloved one-eyed dog after it went missing when the car it was in was stolen. Pete had been less distraught after his Boston Terrier Bailey and his silver BMW were taken from outside a shop in Henley in Arden, Warwickshire, at about 4 o'clock last Tuesday. He dropped his keys after leaving Bailey briefly on the passenger seat while he went back into Henley Boutique on the High Street to retrieve his phone. They were picked up by a female pedestrian, but she handed them over to the thief when he told her they were his. Following the theft, search organiser Frankie Johns said 9-year-old Bailey was Pete's best mate and child, adding he was not really bothered about the car. He has since confirmed that Bailey had been found on her own in Sheldon and was now back with the owner, but the car remains missing. The 9-year-old dog is its owner's best mate, a village dog who everybody loved and patted. Everybody knows her. She's so beautiful, and you can really recognise her because she's only got one eye. Warwickshire Police said it received a report on Tuesday of a BMW stolen from Henley in Arden with a dog inside, highlighting that the animal was only left for a few minutes. The force urged witnesses or those with dashcam or doorbell footage to get in touch.
A 66-year-old sculpture has been removed for safety reasons after being snapped from its mounts in a Coventry city centre pool. The vandalism of the Naiad in Coventry's upper precinct was discovered by tour guide Scott Duffin and has been reported to police. Mr. Duffin said that the life-size depiction of a water nymph had been moved from its original position and was just sitting, waiting to be carried away. George Wagstaff's sculpture, made in fibreglass in 1958, was replaced in bronze during the 1980s. She has had various homes in the city, including outside the Herbert Museum, and was relocated to the Upper Precinct during the City of Culture celebrations in 2021. The sculpture was previously tethered to a higher point in the pool by screws, which had been removed. The City Council said it was aware that the Naiad had been detached from its fixings and staff are checking CCTV coverage. In the meantime, We are removing her to ensure she is safe until we can arrange to get her back into place securely fixed, the spokesperson added. Describing what he had seen, Mr. Duffin said, she was a lot further back up in the pool, and she'd been snapped from the attachments, and was now down near the bottom. Quite easily now, one or two people could just have picked her up and walked away with her if they'd wanted to. West Midlands Police called it a shocking incident of criminal damage and appealed for anyone with information to get in touch.
And finally, an item to make you think. A sight loss charity is teaching trainee guide dogs how to deal with delivery robots after owners reported their pups were unnerved. The Guide Dogs Training Centre in Leamington Spa has teamed up with the firm behind the technology so dogs in training could be familiarised with it. Starship Technologies donated a robot shell to the charity and pledged to support working dogs reacting to the machines on the streets. Autonomous six-wheeled delivery bots travel on pavement to deliver food, groceries and packages. They were introduced in Milton Keynes 6 years ago and have since expanded to towns around the UK, with firms such as the Co-op and DPD opting in. Guide dog trainer Paul Lennon explained a couple of service users had highlighted dogs' strange reactions to them. We expect the use of delivery robots to really go up over the next few years, he said. We wanted to have a training aid to make sure the dogs are not going to be held back by things they meet on the streets. Staff at the charity said they were really pleased with the progress already made by apprentice guide dog Vinny. Golden Retriever Vinny's training introduced him to the static bot in a room strewn with boxes, toys and sniff mats, with movement incorporated later. Scattered treats fostered a positive association, Mr. Lennon explained, adding he was really pleased with the two-year-old's progress. We'll do this time and time again just to make sure that the dogs are really happy with it. Ryan Holroyd Case from Starship Technologies said its partnership with the charity would deepen their understanding of how guide dogs interacted with the technology. Over the years, we've conducted testing with guide dogs to observe their reactions, he said. We found many dogs work very well around our robots without distraction, but some need a little more support. The Leamington-based Guide Dog Training Centre is the largest in the country, supporting about 250 owners in the area.
My thanks there to Elaine and Peter for the news. Just a couple of things I was going to mention. You were talking about Pete Waterman being a local lad, which I'd forgotten. But of course, the other buff is Rod Stewart, isn't it? He's very much into toy train. Did I mention toy train? Probably the wrong expression, but he trained as well.
Model railways.
Model railways, thank you. A couple of other reminders. Firstly, lighting up and lighting down, of course, as always. Sunrise is at 5:35 and sunset at 8:30. We've had recently a number of wallets come, not many, one or two in the last fortnight, have come back unzipped, which means, unfortunately, the memory stick has fallen out. So can you please, everyone, ensure that it's zipped up before you pop it in the postbox? And finally, before I introduce you, we were talking, Jag mentioned about, can we get recommendations for places to eat? I've seen a recommendation recently, highly highlighted by people's comments, that the Cowden pub's really pretty good. So there's another one to add to your list. Now, on to Hugh and the centre.
Thank you very much. Well, I can add a couple more, actually. So the Open Arms do an excellent, which is just in Charlesmoor, do an excellent Sunday lunch. It's pretty good value. Yep. And actually, if you like Turkish food, the Bosphorus Istanbul here in Earlston is terrific.
Is that in the main street?
It is, yeah. Oh, right. In what was the Coventry Building Society.
Oh,
we've been there a few times. And yeah. It's very good.
And can I add that the burnt post does exactly the same as the open arms.
Oh, yeah.
And is equally very good.
Yeah. So there's lots of options there. Look, come to us for the advice of these things. Yeah.
And people out there, if they've got a suggestion, do let us know.
Yeah. Well, hello, everybody. I've got a few things to talk to you about this time. I've been banging on about Showdown for the last several number of weeks. We now have identified a day on which we are going to be doing a have a go session, and it's going to make it a sort of a bit of a social affair, really. So the date to put in your diary is the 29th of May. That's a Wednesday, and it's going to take place from 5 o'clock in the evening until 9 o'clock in the evening, or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. That means that people can stay if they're here for craft group or whatever, and you can stay till 9 o'clock if you want. We will arrange transport and things if we can. Certainly to get people home. But, what we're going to do is make it a bit social, so we'll get, like, some samosas and onion bargees in from the from Falls Hill Road, and, maybe pizzas in from Costco or whatever. We'll ask for contribution and everything, but it's basically to come in and have a go at doing it. It'll you don't have to be there the whole 4 hours. You can drop in for an hour or so and have a go, or couple of hours, whatever, just have a little evening,
have a bash,
literally, actually. So that'll be good. There'll be British Blind Sport, who we're working with on this. They're putting a day together, I think, for the 29th of June, so a month later, where people can come along as well if they're really interested to sort of learn some tips and tricks and techniques. It'll also be an opportunity for anybody who wants to volunteer to support the group to find out what that could involve. Also, coaches and referees will also have a bit of training available on that day as well, we hope. So, 29th of May, it's a Wednesday, 5 to 9 p.m. Buses will be available. If you're interested, please will you let either Heather or Carol know on reception, or Chris. And you can call us on 024-7671-7522. Press 0 for reception, that'll take you straight through to there, or 2 for Chris, and that'll take you straight through to him. You can leave a message on his phone as well. A little sooner than that, this coming Monday, Bank Holiday Monday, I'd like to remind you that the centre is closed. Well, for all normal activities. However, the Earlston Festival takes place on Monday. The weather's looking a little 50-50, it has to be said, and it literally, it could be raining half the time and not raining half the time. But we're keeping our fingers crossed. Anyway, we're going very large in the car park again this time. There will be lots of really good stuff available from the charity shop. There will be a plant sale from the allotment club, some great quality plants. There will be a vast amount of rhubarb. I know there will be a vast amount of rhubarb because it comes from our vast rhubarb plot. Roll up, get your rhubarb here. The other really important thing I want to say about the charity shop sale is that we have scored quite a lot of really rather good Lego sets. And so what we're going to do is, we thought about pricing it all up and everything, and it's fine, but we're probably underpricing it, to be perfectly honest. So what we're going to do is we're going to do a silent auction for the Lego. So people come along, they'll be able to look at all the Lego bits that we've got, and they'll be able to submit a bid for it, a sealed bid, and then at the end of the day, whoever has bid the most will win the Lego, and they'll be required to pay for it. So that's how it's going to roll. If you, or, perhaps more likely, a friend or relative is absolutely bonkers about Lego, and there are people who are bonkers about Lego in the same way that there are people who are bonkers about model railways or toy trains or whatever you want to call them, then it's definitely worth coming along, because there's some absolutely fabulous stuff, and it has the opportunity of making the charity a good amount of money. Judith Missenden. Hi, Judith. Called me over yesterday. She said, ooh, the British Heart Foundation have produced a new booklet in Braille. So I'm just going to tell you about it. It's called Keep Your Heart Healthy, and it's in the Braille version. It's been printed for blind people on how to keep your heart healthy. It covers some of the main risk factors of heart and circulatory diseases and the things you can do to keep your heart healthy. You can order a copy of the Braille booklet by calling the British Heart Foundation. I don't know. We'll help you. We'll find the number for you if you don't know where it is. Helpfully, they also suggest you could also read a PDF version of the Braille the Braille book, or download it. Which doesn't come out in Braille anyway. So I thought that was a bit funny. Well done for trying. It is available in Braille, and you'll have to order it, and they will send it through to you in the post. Good idea to keep your heart healthy, and they will give you the advice on how to do that in Braille if that's how you would like it. Talking of keeping yourself healthy, we have a number of exercise opportunities here at the centre. We've got space in the Tai Chi group, and if you would... fancy doing some really lovely, gentle exercise. It's very meditative. It's very good for building your muscle tone and improving your balance. Tai Chi's excellent at that. There's plenty of space, and it takes place on a Thursday afternoon. It goes from, from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock in Boston Lodge. The people who do it love it, and so we've got extra space there. So if you fancy having a go, you don't even have to commit. Come along and have a go at it, and if you love it, come every week. If you don't love it, don't come every week. But excuse me. Similarly, we've also got a little bit of space on yoga, which is a bit more hardcore, has to be said, but also adapted in the same way as Tai Chi is, for people with visual impairments. Obviously, everybody who does that class does these classes has a visual impairment, so don't think that would stop you from doing it. Again, very good exercise. Even more intense muscle workouts and bendability and all the other things that it offers. So if you fancy getting onto those groups, give us a call at the centre. Speak to Heather or Carol or Chris. Even more exercise opportunity, of course. We have the Move for Fun event, which is taking place on the 19th of May. So that is what used to be the Walkathon, and it's operated by the Learfrick Lions. They wanted to open it out so that people could cycle it if they want, or do it on pogo sticks, whatever. So it's a few times around the park. Now, what we would really love is for you to do it, or get one of your relatives or friends to do it, and get yourself sponsored and give the money to us. That would be really, really lovely. We're going to have a number of people from the walking group going and doing it. Peter, who's sitting right opposite me, will be leading that charge at a modest pace, I'm quite sure. And but if anybody else would like to take part, and particularly get some sponsorship, and that would be a great little way to raise money. If you're interested in doing that, give us a call again on the centre number, but this time go through to Claire, and Claire will furnish you with all the forms you need, all the information you need to go around getting sponsored and everything.
And what extension is she on?
Now you're asking. I think she might be on extension 8.
Okay.
I'm hoping that she's on extension 8.
Alternatively,
just go through to us. It'll tell you when you phone in. You just have to sit there for a while and it'll eventually get round to everybody. Now, finally, I did talk about this a few weeks ago, but Sight Village is coming up in Birmingham in July. Now, Sight Village, for those of you who don't know, is basically a showcase for new technology designed to support people with visual impairments, so daily living aids, that sort of thing. And really, the very newest stuff that they've got will be showcased there. Now, this year, for the first time, we're actually going to organise a trip to go, and we're going to go on Tuesday the 9th of July. The actual absolute details about what time we'll leave the door, but we're gonna either do it with we're probably going to do it with the buses. So on that day, for example, rather than do devices workshop, we're going to go to Site Village. There will be a £10 charge for that though, so you'll need to save up. but that's to do with transport. I mean, you can make your own way there. It takes place in the East Side Rooms Conference Centre, which is in Woodcock Street. It's not right in the middle of Birmingham, not by a long chalk, but it's a bit closer to the middle of Birmingham than Queen Alexandra College is, which is out in the Bundoo of Birmingham, really. So I think it would be a really good thing to go and see. There probably will be some limits on places, but we'll you know, if everybody wants to go, then we'll work out some other means of getting people there. So if you're interested in going to Site Village on Tuesday the 9th of July for £10, then give us a call on the centre number, talk to Heather or Carol, or indeed Chris on this occasion, and we'll get your name down. And that, dear friends, is it.
How long do you reckon you'll stay there? The idea? Half a day?
Half-day visit sort of thing. So, I mean, it starts at 9:30 and goes on till 3:30.
Yeah.
So we'd probably get there by sort of 10:30-ish, I should imagine, and probably come away by 2, so, three, 4 hours.
So they throw their piggy bank for a sort of bite to eat.
Yes, right, quite absolutely. And I think what they do there is they have quite a lot of volunteers around who will take people and guide them around to see the things that they want to see, which is an important consideration for a lot of people. We'll sort out about, there'll be some volunteers from here as well coming, so there we are.
Good, thank you, Hugh. Do we expect to see you next week? You're going away again tonight, Hugh?
No, not for a while. I won't be here on the 29th of May, but that's about
A while ahead, yes. Okay, thanks so much. So, from news here at the centre, we move on to sport with Sarah.
Well, hello there, lovely listeners, and welcome to sport. Yes, I know you're all rushing to get to your fast forward button because you don't like sport. But come on, guys, give me a chance. Just see, you might find something you do like. And if you don't, you'll probably hear a cat groaning in the background. He's asleep. And it's my ginger boy, Freddie. Right. Coventry City, after losing midweek to our nearest promotion rivals, Hull City, headed up north to Blackburn to play Blackburn Rovers. And the final result of a 0-0 draw has meant that Coventry now cannot qualify for the playoffs for promotions. But all in all, I think we've had a very good season for what basically was a newly constructed club, really, given the number of players we had. I have to say, if I was one of their fans, I'd be pretty annoyed with a 0-0 draw, because I just felt, listening on the radio, that they had the bulk of the play and we was lucky. One of the few highlights were two red cards given. Well, the real highlight was the one given to the Blackburn manager. We're not really sure why, but anyway, he was banished from the touchline up into the stands or wherever he has to go and sit. But then, towards the end, one of our defenders, Kitchen, picked up a red card as well. And I have to say, that is Kitchen's third red card of the season. So I think he's got a little bit of anger management and behaviour to learn there. But it was lovely to see our former player and real Coventry, well, we liked him very much, Carl McFadzie, who sort of has been to one club and another in his later years or months, and now plays for Blackburn. Absolutely heralded by our fans at the end, and he didn't sort of really bother with his teammates much, but he went up and he was hugging our players and hugging the assistant manager and went off arm in arm with our manager. Yes, Carl, we do really miss you. So going down quite a lot of leagues, and I'll explain a bit more about the league structure in a minute because I finally sussed it out. Stratford were away to Royston and came away 3-2 winners. Unfortunately, Stratford had missed the promotions playoffs purely on goal difference. But never mind, Stratford, you've had a great season, particularly when you think of how you were last year, constantly fighting relegation. However, our other Warwickshire team at that level, Leamington, beat Sudbury 2-0, which meant they finished third in their league and are in the promotions playoffs. And because they finished high up, they've got home advantage. So by the time you're listening to this, they will have played their semi-final at home to Redditch because it's on Wednesday. Now, moving down quite a few leagues to actually what is the lowest of the leagues, Racing Club Warwick were playing in a real nail-biter because they knew that if they won, they'd gain automatic promotion. And they did. They ran out 2-0 winners. So well done, Racing Club. You are now in the 8th level. So, I'm now going to explain a bit about, well, they call it a sort of football pyramid, but it's not really, it's like a triangle with a spike. At level 9, there are the majority of the non-league clubs, and most of them are really quite small clubs. That's where my little Coventry United are, and currently, but not next year, Racing Club Warwick were. Then in level 8, you've got clubs like Coventry Sphinx, Rugby Town, and that's where Racing Club Warwick will be heading next season. Then in level 7, you've got clubs like Leamington and Stratford, who are hoping to get into level 6. But then in level 5, you've got teams like Solihull Moors. And level 5 is the ones who are just knocking on the door of getting promotion to Division 2. And then that spike I talked about, basically you've just got one league at level Division 2, one league Division 1, one Championship and one Premiership. Well, I sort of understand it, but I wish they'd sort of be a bit more uniform with their names. Anyway, Solihull Moors already heading for Wembley for the FA Vars beat Barnet midweek away in the semi-final for the playoffs. So they are now in the final for the playoffs, which would put them, if they win, into the English Football League's Division 2. And that was the journey last year that teams including Wrexham and Newport took. And of course, Wrexham have gained promotion already to Division 1. So, come on, Solihull! And haters of football will be pleased to know that we are nearing the end of the football season. Well, I say nearing, I think sort of the FA Cup final is around the 20th of May, give or take a few days. Then there's a short break and we go into the men's European Championships. Then, of course, we have football at the Olympics. Then we start again! Oh, lucky, lucky us. And the Olympics is only 86 days away. Yes! Getting very excited. Did you listen or watch the Women's Six Nations match yesterday? You know, the concluding match, France versus England, the one that was billed as it would be really tight and a real grudge match. Well, it was a grudge match. In fact, the crowd couldn't have been any more hostile to our lovely Red Roses. But my gosh, we stormed our way to the title and the Grand Slam, our third in 3 years, with a 21-42 win. And people were saying it would be close, just a try or two in it. Well done also to the Ireland women, who for the first time have qualified for the next Women's World Cup by finishing third. Not some good news though for Wales, who finished at the bottom and were relegated and will have to qualify to be in the World Cup. Oh well, you can do it, ladies. Now, tennis, one of my other favourite sports. Well, the circuit's still revolving. Yes, I said revolving, not revolting. And it's currently in Madrid for the Madrid Open. Well, we are now into the third round. And oh, I'm afraid all of our players seem to have exited in the first or second round. But the great news is for Rafa Nadal. You know, that man who's held together with string and sellotape. He's got a bad knee, a bad hip, a bad ankle, a bad pretty much everything to do with his legs. But he is now in the third round, having beaten one of the French seeds, Di Matteo, who was really well fancied. So well done, Rafa. Keep it going, please. And wouldn't it be lovely to see him in the French Open, which is the tournament that he has won so many times. So the French Open begins on May the 20th, ends June the 9th. Wimbledon starts on June the 30th, and in between we have the mass of small tournaments where the players acclimatise and transition from the hard surface to the grass. Gymnastics, and I apologise to those of you who aren't a gymnastics fan like what I is, but let's be honest, when you're even as an adult only 5 foot tall and 7.5 stone and were much smaller as a child, it was about the only sport that I could do. Last week saw the men's section of the European Championships, and Great Britain came away with 2 of the 6 titles. My gosh, we've come a long way from the days when it was fingers crossed that he's going to land this back somersault. Anyway, Jake Jarman won the vault, and Whitehouse, apologies, I don't have his first name, won the floor. So well done, lads. Oh, and Max Whitlock wasn't there because he got a slight niggle, so he was resting. Well, Max, you are a veteran at 31, and you have got a rather big tournament coming up in 86 days, and you have already won the British Championship. So I think we'll forgive you, and select you for that big championship. Also to do with gymnastics, do you remember Amy Tinkler, or the name Amy Tinkler? She's the lass who won a bronze medal at the Rio Games as a really, really, really young gymnast, and then blew the whistle on a lot of the abuse that had gone on training and with the coaches, etc. Well, she's back on the world scene, but not, I hasten to add, in gymnastics. No, she now competes in a team event, the World Cheerleading Championship. Never knew it existed. But hey-ho, well done, Amy. And finally, you may have heard that Great Britain's Olympic kit was launched recently and modelled by Tom, you know, my heartthrob, Tom Daly. So I thought I'd have a go at sort of giving you a description of it. Basically, the colours are red, white and blue of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And the lower half, be it the running shorts, the diving trunks, the tracksuit bottoms, etc., are dark navy. And the top half is white, with certainly the tracksuit has got sort of like two broad bands down the sleeve, which are a bit like ribbons in that they cross over about halfway down. And the one of those is blue and the one is red. And then across the back, in capital letters, it has the words Great Britain. Now, I'm not quite sure what's happened to the Northern Ireland, because in the Olympics, we are always Great Britain and NI. So I'm assuming that we've also got the and NI in capitals, but just somewhere. And it's produced by Adidas. So as you can imagine, there are lots of those three stripes everywhere. And I can't wait to see it being worn. And talking about Tom Daly, how the heck does he keep his shorts on diving from that high board? And they're so little. But anyway, that's just me thinking and being a bit naughty. Anyway, listeners, and I do hope I've gained one or two more. Hope you've enjoyed Miss Sport, and it's lovely to speak to you all. And I will continue to do so next week. Bye.
Thanks, Sarah. I must say that the clothing sounds pretty smart, so I'm sure that you will be looking forward to seeing it in action. Just 86 days to go. Now, let's find out what Dave's got in his postbag this week.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello there, and welcome to your postbag once again. I'd like to start off by saying what a lovely event the Alpaca Walk and Meerkat experience was, and how nice it was to spend the day with some of the listeners. New member of the Monday Club, Elizabeth, wasn't quite sure who I was on Outlook. Gemma, who was with Tony when we were having a meal together, said, "Dave's the one with a husky voice." It reminded me of the anonymous Valentine card I received when I was about 18. Among the words were, "Your husky voice will not let my poor heart rest." Never knew who it was. Thank you, Gemma. As promised, Graham Whale is going to tell you how you might be able to save a serious amount of money on your water bills, particularly if you live alone or in a very small household. So, as they said in Hello, Hello, listen very carefully. He shall say this only once.
Speaking of money, they came round to put water meters in our street a couple of years back. And I've had my friends tell me, "Oh, you want to switch over to a meter, you'd be better off just by yourself. You'll be a lot better off," and I've been putting it off. Anyway, when I get my water bill this year for something like £760, I thought, yeah, I'm going to look into this. So when I rang them up to pay the bill, I discussed the possibility of changing over to the meter, and they said, "Oh, well, you'd have saved £400. So I said, "Right, that's it then, I'm going to switch over to a water meter." This week I get a cheque from Severn Trent for over £1,000. Customer refund, that's all it says. No idea what for, but it's going in the bank. But I would suggest to anybody, if you live alone or if you live in a small family unit where there's just two of you, You could be better off on a water meter if you have them in the street. So it is well worth looking into it, I think. I hope I prove right in my decision.
Thank you, Graham, for that brilliant piece of information. So phone your water company if you think you could save money. That's the kind of information we need in Postbag to help your fellow listeners. So send some more in. Julia can't be with us in Postbag this week, so get well soon, Julia. Her friend John, though, is standing in for her. So here he is with the report entitled Musings of an Old Man. Here we go again, cast aside and left adrift through the wilderness. My friend Julia is still on the bottle, so I'm left to help keep the Postbag ship afloat. To be fair, that's not a normal trait of mine. Julia has lost a voice, which apparently impedes her typing skills. Honestly, nothing to do with all the gin. Anyway, enough of me casting aspersions. Pour it down the sink, Julia, and you'll soon recover. By the way, in case anybody takes me too seriously, my friend Julia doesn't drink. I'm just getting my own back. To be serious, I was so sorry to hear of Bob Symes' loss. I never knew Topper, but I do remember Bob with a previous dog, and like most guide dog relationships, they were very close. Can't remember the previous dog's name because I'm very old. It's always a wrench when any relationship ends, but the relationship between a guide dog and its owner is necessarily one of deep interdependence. My condolences, Bob. Actually, I do remember in those early computer sessions, the tea breaks when we'd all gather round the metaphorical campfire. Trish wouldn't let us have a real one. And Bob would regale us with tales of his youth. He told us about the occasional slum course on bin days when the dog dragged Bob weaving in and out between the bins on the way home from the shop, or was it the pub? Another day he told us about the dog, who was very headstrong, refusing to leave the house if it was raining, unless he had previously heard Bob phone for a cab. Have I got those tales right, Bob? It was a long time ago. That's enough from me. Let's hope Julia's back next week. I need my fix of sherbet lemons. Have a good week, everybody. Julia's friend, John. Thanks a lot, John, for standing in for Julia. That was brilliant. And here's a message to you, Bob, from Doreen.
Hello, Bob. This is Doreen Hilton speaking to you. I'm very, very sorry to hear that you've lost your dog after so many years, of 20 years or more. I do remember you when you used to be on the CVS, starting it from Jubilee Crescent. Yes, as a dog, as a guide dog, it must be a great, great miss to you. I really feel sorry for you. I have dogs of my own. When you lose them, but not guide dogs actually, other dogs, and you do really miss them, because you take them a part of your family as a child, and they're very, very company. But as for a guide dog, it does its work. I know somebody that comes from Bedworth in the name of Keith, and I saw what he did with his dog in Morrison's in Holbrooks here. And he lost his dog, and he felt the same way as you. So my heart goes out for you, and I think of you. I hope that you will be able to get another one shortly. It is a 2 years waiting list, or 6 months. But anyway, Bob, I do wish you all the best, and hope you're feeling a little bit better in yourself. It is very hard to get over with. Okay, Bob, as I say, I do remember you from many, many years ago. Doreen Hilton, signing off. Goodbye, Bob. Bob, thank you.
Thank you, Doreen. We're very sorry for your loss, Bob. Keep in touch, please. Finally, with this mixed weather, Edwina has some advice about getting your sunshine vitamin D. First, she tells you to have a variety of colours in your food.
Hi, everybody. It's Edwina. We're on food this time, but with colours. So we do have some brightly coloured foods. Any brightly foods that you eat are good for you. So if you think of the red tomatoes, and then we have some of the green for salads, like the lettuce, cucumber, spring onion, all these different beautiful foods for us to enjoy. Now, if you move into the garden, you've still got the green with the many cabbages and the green kidney beans and the peas, amaro with its stripes, and carrots with the orange, and so it goes on. But any food that you eat which a bright colour, like we'll say oranges. Oranges are vitamin C. It's all good. If we're thinking of the spring, which is now with the bright sunshine, which is helping a lot of people that become very low in the winter, you can actually try vitamin D, because vitamin D lifts moods. So when your mood is lifted, you will feel better in yourself. So that's something else that is good for us in tablet form. Some people do take vitamin D all year round. It's a good idea, keeping good in yourself. Keep smiling, everybody. Bye.
Thank you, Edwina. So if you have vitamin D deficiency, don't blame it on the sunshine. Don't blame it on the moonlight. Blame it on the boogie. So, Edwina is recommending vitamin D supplements. Hopefully we'll be able to get out in the fresh air soon with the nice weather coming and get some vitamin D naturally. Thank you for your messages this week, and please let's hear from you next time. Bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
Elaine's reading of them is Like Radio for Extra, a repeat of the series which, as some of our longer-term Outlook listeners will recall, was first read by the late George Griffin many years ago. Now, this week, Elaine travels to Arrow.
Nowadays, the traffic thunders out of the old Roman town of Ulster on the A422 and rushes off to Evesham and the world beyond. And thus, you miss Arrow. For the little village straggles this busy highway. It is an old village, and until recent years was owned by the Marquis of Hertford, who still lives in the village at Ragley Hall. Its main inhabitants in those early days were the employees and retired workers from the estate. But the social climate has changed now, and the great estates do not employ a large staff as of old. These days, new houses are being built and old ones converted for the folks who commute into nearby towns. The beautiful, fertile land is owned by the Marquis, and the sheep and cattle graze beside the woodland, alive with deer and pheasant. All around, neat hedgerows and well-tilled fields give notice of the richness of the land and the careful attention it receives. On the banks of the River Arrow is an old watermill, which, until a few decades ago, was still grinding corn. The original mill was mentioned in the Domesday Book and dates back to 766. The setting is still beautiful and the mill wheel still turns, although now it is part of a hotel restaurant. Upmarket from the mill is Arrow Church, a 12th century Norman church which is still lovingly cared for, although the adjacent rectory and coach house are now private dwellings. The boundary between Ulster and Arrow is Spittle Brook, and here there is a waterman's cottage, and, still in the garden below, the old reservoir, a water wheel, one of the oldest metal wheels in England, which operated to supply Ulster, 1.5 miles away. Beloved of many generations of children is the elephant tree. Set in the bank, just beyond the waterman's cottage, is the great trunk of an ancient oak tree, which has grown to have all the texture and shape of an elephant. How many childhood fantasies must have been woven to explain his presence there? Sadly, the tree and the water wheel are both threatened by future development plans. At the junction between the Worcester and Evesham roads, there is a toll house built in the 1850s, which could control both roads and collect tolls for the Marquis from the travellers with their livestock. On the Worcester Road at this junction lived the wheelwright, and opposite was the forge and blacksmith's cottage. As the motor car became king, the enterprising wheelwright opened a garage, but even this has gone now, and a new house has taken its place. The schoolhouse, which was built in the mid-19th century, and the village shop have both closed, the former being offices. Ragley Hall, set in rolling parkland, has a commanding position and comes unexpectedly into view in all its grandeur when travelling from Stratford or Worcester. The hall and park are open to the public with nature walks and an adventure playground for the children. There is a heronry in Ragley Park, and early mornings will catch a group of herons on the river bank, like old men chatting about the weather. The Marquis tells the story of the Arrow ghost. There is a spring on the main road between Arrow and Dunnington, at the foot of Ragley Park. Towards the end of the 19th century, travellers in coaches often saw a little old lady beside the spring, begging a lift towards the village of Dunnington. Those who gave her a lift invariably found that she had disappeared when they stopped at Dunnington Crossroad to let her out of the carriage. Eventually, someone had the idea of digging around the spring, and they found the bones of an old lady. The bones were reburied in Arrow Churchyard in about 1900, and the ghostly old lady was never seen again.
The late Peter Sellers became an international star after his wonderful depiction of the hapless Inspector Clouseau in the original Pink Panther film, the story of which Keith started recounting last week and which he now concludes.
The shoot at the alpine resort of Cortina d'Ampezzo was no picnic. In one scene, Robert Wagner, who plays George, Lytton's handsome nephew, has to hide fully clothed in a bath, alongside Cappuccine, under a vast number of bubbles. Sadly, the foaming agent used was a bit too powerful, and left both stars temporarily injured. Wagner claimed, "The results of that were very frightening because I'd burned the corneas of my eyes." He recovered in time to finish filming, and the incident didn't stop Wagner later calling the movie the most wonderful picture I ever worked on. Italian actress Claudia Cardinale's lines had to be dubbed, and while Edwards later reflected on his luck in having to swap Ustinov for Sellers, the tortured genius was far from easy to work with. Sellers, who claimed not to have a personality beyond his characters, had just divorced his wife Anne, the first of his four marriages. He suffered from depression and became dependent on drugs, alcohol, and sessions with a psychic. Edwards later recalled, Sellers was nuts, really nuts, adding he was all over the place emotionally. Our relationship soured almost from the start. Sellers even told the Pink Panthers producers that the film was a disaster before it opened, only for it to become a box office smash and propel him to greater stardom. In fact, he had stolen the show so much that the following Oscar ceremony, Niven refused to walk on stage to music from the movie, observing tartly, "That was not really my film." Of course, it wasn't just Peter Sellers who made the Pink Panther a phenomenon. The pioneering animated roguish Pink Panther also became iconic, eventually getting his very own cartoon series. And Henry Mancini's catchy saxophone theme tune became a top 10 hit in the US. And there was an enjoyable cameo from Dad's Army star John LeMessurier playing a lawyer. Both Edwards and Sellers initially walked away from a Pink Panther sequel, but were eventually persuaded to join forces for A Shot in the Dark, released later in 1964. This time Clouseau was the lead character, with Sellers hamming up an even thicker accent he had based on a real French hotel concierge, alongside his co-star, German actress Elke Sommer. Inspired additions to the formula also saw Bert Kwok play Clouseau's servant Cato, with the running gag that he would repeatedly attack the inspector unexpectedly to hone his martial arts skills. Herbert Lom excelled as Commissioner Dreyfus, driven slowly mad by his underling's blundering. Both would become regulars in the series. After the movie wrapped, Edwards and Sellers' tempestuous working relationship saw them vow to never speak again. However, after a dud 1968 Pink Panther movie starring Alan Arkin as Clouseau, the pair were finally talked into reuniting for 1975's The Return of the Pink Panther. By this time, Sellers had been leading a jet-set lifestyle, which had seen him splash out on fast cars, marry and divorce Bond girl Britt Eklund, and suffer a major heart attack. He was badly in need of the cash. But his erratic behaviour became legendary. He once flounced off set at Shepperton Studios to take a flight to Germany, and he'd phone Edwards in the middle of the night to tell him how God had told him how to play a certain scene. The pair eventually resorted to communicating via assistants. Yet the Pink Panther films were making a mint again. Sellers became a multimillionaire, and two more movies, The Pink Panther Strikes Again, 1976, and Revenge of the Pink Panther, 1978, followed before tragedy struck. Sellers suffered another big heart attack in 1977. He had a pacemaker fitted, and his dodgy health meant a double sometimes had to be used during filming. Yet it was still a shock when his ticker finally gave out on July the 24th, 1980. He was just 54. After his death, the franchise stumbled on with another five films, including one cobbled together from offcuts and a mediocre Steve Martin reboot in the 2000s. Yet, as Pink Panther producer Walter Mirisch observed, the old Sellers classics still continue to entertain audiences around the world.
Jacques Clouseau often mispronounced English words, but one person who certainly doesn't is Susie Dent, and here's Margaret with another of Susie's dictionary corners.
Cataract. Many words in English have multiple meanings that are so different from each other, it's hard to imagine any connection. One of these is cataract, which can mean both a spectacular waterfall and a medical condition of the eye. But the two meanings are in fact related. In Latin, cataracta, from the Greek cataractes, is downrushing, meant both a waterfall and a portcullis, a grating pulled down to close a gateway. It was this meaning that inspired the use of cataract for the clouding of the lens of the eye, as if a gate has been lowered, obstructing vision. It's not the only eye condition with a backstory. Glaucoma is derived from the Greek for an owl, glaucus, because the bird was thought to have eyes similar in colour to those of a glaucoma sufferer. In the lurch. The vocabulary of games has given English plenty of words and expressions. For example, we owe the many meanings of check to chess, known in French as échec. Two opponents may be described as level pegging, thanks to cribbage, in which scores are often shown via pegs on a board. The phrase in the lurch, meanwhile, is used in various games when one player is significantly ahead of the other, or in which the loser scores nothing. In cribbage, a lurch can involve a situation in which the loser has yet to score 31 before the winner reaches 61. The word lurch itself may derive from the German dialect word lurch, meaning left or wrong, the left traditionally being associated with bad luck or misfortune. Quiz. Behind the word that peppers our TV and radio listings lies one of English etymology's most popular stories. The earliest record of quiz dates from the late 18th century, when it described an eccentric individual or a ridiculous thing. In the 1920s, the word came to mean a series of questions provided as entertainment. The word is said to have been the brainchild of an 18th century Irish actor and theatre manager named Richard Daly, who took on a bet that he could invent a word and have it become the talk of the town within 24 hours. He did so by having quiz chalked or pasted around Dublin. The chronology would fit, and a theatre manager called Richard Daly existed. But we don't have any definitive evidence. The word may simply derive from the adjective inquisitive. The nick of time. At the end of the 16th century, people began to use the phrase in the very nick to describe a critical moment or exact time at which something needed to happen. The nick here is the same word we use for a small cut, as in when we accidentally nick our finger with something sharp. The reference is to a narrow, precise cut, such as you might find on a tally stick, a piece of wood that was marked at close intervals with notches from a knife as a means of keeping score, a word that also involves making a notch, scoring, on a piece of wood as a means of calculation. Nick, therefore, was used for a precise marker, particularly when it came to a crucial moment. The phrase ultimately settled on the specific context in the term in the nick of time.
Bill last week started talking about TikTok, and I for one had the fog of understanding different generation nomenclature explained, and I'm starting to understand Gen Z, Gen Alpha, Millennials and all the rest of them. Hopefully you are all now equally clear and will appreciate the conclusion of Bill's story of TikTok.
2 months before the National Portrait Gallery reopened last June, after a three-year, £36 million refurbishment, Wes was granted a behind-the-scenes visit for this very purpose. Wearing a hard hat and high-vis jacket for her loyal TikTok followers, many of whom might not know the gallery, she revealed previously hidden architectural features, including beautiful cut glass windows hidden behind a hoarding for decades. "I'm on a mission to improve heritage and history for young people," she says. "As children, we're taken to historic places and don't go again until our 30s with families of our own. There's a gap in the middle. 20s are the missing decade. Everyone in the heritage world is keen to make things more accessible. So it's a very positive world to work in. There's always pressure on social media to be trend-driven. But Alice insists she never compromises on historical integrity. A mistake that is often made with young people is to try to attract them with the current thing," she says. "It can work, but it's not really necessary. What I've seen is that they are interested in history for the bare bones. You don't always have to dress it up. The fact that I can make videos about the wonderful encaustic tiles in Winchester Cathedral goes viral shows that there is fascination with genuine history. In February, Canterbury Cathedral held a controversial silent disco to reach out to younger people, raise the large sums that places of worship now requires to survive. The event, at which headphone-wearing partygoers danced to tracks from the likes of All Saints and brought drinks from a licensed bar, attracted attention for all the wrong reasons. As crowds entered the holy building, Christian protesters faced the rain to sing hymns and to call for an end to the absurd idea, declaring they did not want rave to Eminem in God's house. Says Alice, "I have massive sympathy for people who are trying to keep the cathedral going. It's a huge job, and credit to anyone who raises money for this. I can understand why a lot of people were disappointed at a sacred space being used in this way, away from its essence, but kudos to Canterbury for thinking outside the box." So how does Alice, who grew up in a musical family with history-loving parents, project topics such as Georgian satire to a more youthful audience? While studying history at Edinburgh University, a tongue-in-cheek history magazine, The Plague, won a National Student Journalism Prize. It featured tabloid-style newspaper headlines, ended with the satirical knowingness of Private Eye. Notable front-page screamers included Ramesses, nude statues force Twitter into meltdown, and rude raiders strike again, Vikings lack manners, monks moan. That was a long time ago, she says, slightly embarrassed. After finishing her four-year history degree at Edinburgh, Alice applied for a job at History Hit TV, television historian Dan Snow's production company. She stayed for 3 years, learning all aspects of TV production. It was a wonderful time, and I was exposed to every possible creative endeavour. Dan is so eloquent and knowledgeable. He's masterful at conveying history in a really engaging way. Dan calls her the next big thing in history, so the admiration is clearly mutual. In 2020, he asked to start the company's TikTok channel. We were ahead of the game. Then I started making them myself. My first viral post was filmed in Covent Garden about hand-blown glass windows. That one did really well, 5.2 million views and counting. I like to find quirky, strange things that people are aware of and reveal their history, like the iron bollards in London. They're actually the cannons from the Napoleonic Wars. I'm in the videos. Most of the time you're watching the object. I try to edit them so you can see the thing that I'm talking about. She dreams of writing screenplays and going into movies as a director or producer. I'd love to be the brains behind a film, she admits. In a world of ever-shortening attention spans, Alice is a pioneer who has found a way to make history relevant to a generation raised on instant gratification. I'm working in a job that didn't exist when I left school 10 years ago, she says. Maybe history, but it's not at all horrible.
I must admit that the proliferation of social media such as TikTok, together with all the others, has tended to leave oldies like me a little bemused. However, now turning to a subject which is simple and straightforward, here's Ali with a tale about hospital food.
The first thing Tina remembered when she woke up in her hospital bed was the overwhelming smell of food. She had collapsed at home, and thanks to the quick thinking of her elderly neighbour, who saw her lying on the floor through the window, she was rushed to hospital after he'd called the ambulance. Tina had hurt her head the day before, when she was hit by a child's frisbee in the park. And although she felt a bit queasy at the time, she didn't give it a moment's thought, and carried on with her day-to-day activities. Later that night, she started with a really bad headache, which just got worse as the day progressed, and no amount of paracetamol would make it go away. She took herself to bed, thinking an early night would sort it out, and although she did feel better the next day, while she was making herself a cup of tea, she felt faint and fell to the floor and was out cold. Thankfully, Charlie, who lived next door, had come over to drop off a lovely bunch of roses from his garden and was about to knock on the back door when he noticed Tina lying on the kitchen floor, and that's when he called for help. Tina really hadn't a clue where she was when she opened her eyes, but it was the smell of food that made her realise she was in hospital, as she'd smelt it so many times before when she was visiting her best friend Sarah, who'd been in hospital for a minor operation. There's something about the smell of hospital food, said Tina to the young nurse who was taking her blood pressure. Yes, and just think how lucky we nurses are not to only smell it every day, but if we're lucky, we get to eat the leftovers as well. The nurse wasn't joking, as Tina found out later. Because of the long shifts they were doing and the lack of decent breaks, the nurses relied on the food being left over, so they could at least have something hot inside them to sustain them throughout the day. I can't believe things are this bad, said Tina to Amy, the nurse. Oh, well, we get used to it, but sometimes it does get us down. And off she went to do the obs on the next person. She had it down to fine art, the observation checks, and it was a big part of her daily routine. Tina felt really sorry for Amy and the other nurses, who had literally run off their feet, and she wished she could do something for them, so they didn't have to rely on the patient's leftovers in order to get a decent meal. Later that day, the doctor came to see Tina, and he told her that the knock on her head had caused a few problems which needed her to stay in hospital a few more days, so they could observe her, because she'd been unconscious. As inconvenient as it was, she wasn't that upset, as she really felt a few days of rest would do her the world of good, and if things did get worse, she was in the right place to get them fixed. Well, as anyone knows who's been in hospital for any length of time, rest is something you don't get, because there's a lot of noise, checks to be made, food to be delivered, eaten and taken away, more observations, blood tests, nurse visits, ward rounds, and of course, the problem patients on the ward that won't stop shouting, day and night. They're everywhere. Sitting up in her hospital bed, Tina witnessed firsthand just how hard the nurses worked under such pressure. She was extremely grateful for all they were doing for her and felt she wanted to do something for them in return, but didn't know what. After a couple of days on the ward, Tina was getting a bit restless and wanted to go home. And thankfully, once the doctor had given her the all clear and there were no more complications with the head, she was able to leave. Getting back to her own bed was wonderful, and it was amazing how quiet her house was compared to the hustle and bustle of the ward. No alarms beeping, no rattling of dinner trays, no noisy patients screaming their heads off in the dead of night. It was pure peace. Once she'd got used to being back at home, Tina decided she wanted to do something nice for Nurse Amy and the fellow nurses as a way of saying thank you, and came up with the idea of a treat hamper for the nurses' station. Tina wasn't short of a bob or two, and set about ordering a giant hamper of goods that could be shared with the nurses, and when it arrived, they could not believe it. Tina didn't tell them it was from her, but she wanted them to have something that at least didn't smell of burnt cabbage, and she made arrangements that every month the huge hamper was sent to them as a way of saying thank you for all they do and continue to do for others. Tina was in a fortunate position as she was self-employed and could work hours that suited her and fit around her other commitments, which she knew the nurses could not do. And it was while she was in hospital, she also noticed just how hard the healthcare assistants worked. They weren't as qualified as the nurses, but worked hard all the same. And when you're lying in a hospital bed like Tina had been, you tended to notice everything that went on and the level of care each patient got, no matter what time of day or night. And that went for the volunteers as well. Yes, things did go wrong from time to time, but that was down to the severe shortage of staff, as there weren't enough nurses to go round. So the healthcare assistants and the volunteers really worked their socks off to ensure people who needed their attention got it. Tina decided she'd look into volunteering at the hospital and found on the website the kind of opportunities that were available. She had the time, she had the enthusiasm, and she had the need to help others. A few months on after her own stay, she was back, but this time in uniform, as a volunteer on the front desk, chatting to visitors, pointing them in the right direction, and generally assisting them with everything from where to pay for the parking to how to get a wheelchair for a patient. It was manic, but she loved it, and she often used to see Nurse Amy on the way in and out of the hospital for a shift. The treat hamper for the nurses still arrives to this day every month. Why? Because Tina signs for them, so she knows they do. And the best thing is, none of them know that they come from her.
I guess most of us have at some time been confined to hospital and have our own opinions of the offerings we were given. Let us know about your experiences in Postbag. A few food and meal treats are often the highlights of holidays. So let's find out what Dave and Graham were up to on their recent holiday in Wales.
Okay, Graham and I are off on our travels. Where are we going, Graham?
You're off to Anglesey.
Well, we arrived in Alnwich by a secluded bay at the top part of Anglesey, and the view out the window is stunning. There's a tree and the coastline and the lovely sea. It is fabulous. And tonight we're going to a gig, aren't we?
Here's the Henry Priestman.
That's right. Okay, he's a singer-songwriter. Fantastic. We've driven to a village about 5.6 miles away.
Now, I was speaking to a member of the audience, Julie. Now, we're staying at a hotel overlooking Bull Bay. You've seen some orcas there, killer whales there, right?
Last summer, yeah. There was a report on Facebook from the local page that said there were orcas in the bay. So we went and we saw them bouncing around there. Yeah, quite close to the shore, two of them.
That's fantastic. So how long have you lived here?
We've been here 12 years this year,
yeah.
And I'm a Mancunian originally,
yeah.
And he's from Colchester.
Colchester,
yeah.
Wonderful, lovely place you've moved to anyway.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, absolutely beautiful. We don't regret 1 minute of it. We love it here. It's fantastic.
Henry Priestman, sing a songwriter right now, and we're looking forward to your entertainment. First of all, where are we?
We're in a place called Clanpeshes.
Okay, great.
Easy for me to say. It's a lovely little village on Anglesey, and we come here every once a week to try and learn Welsh, and we're gradually getting there. And it's just a really lovely community, so we just thought, right, well, let's do something for the community. So, yeah, we do these gigs. I did one last year and the year before, and I'm not with my normal compadre Les, because it's just a tiny place, and it's not really worth him driving 2 hours and the petrol and everything, but yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, now what's the name of the pub, by the way?
The Cavern Glass.
And what does that mean? It
means the blue back, the blue ridge. Yeah. So glass is blue, Cavern is ridge or back. Yeah. So I assume there was a ridge here originally, or whatever.
Yeah,
I'm glad I jammed up before this interview.
So what brought you to Anglesey? Because you were born in Hull.
Born in Hull, and went to college in Liverpool, and then we just came here once, and we just fell in love with the place. Just it's magical, you know. It's and we've really started getting involved with the community. You know, what goes on in here. We say we're trying to learn Welsh, which is really hard, especially at a certain age, but. Yeah, we love it here. It's magical.
Are you in big demand around here?
No, not at all. No, I mean, this is the only gig I... we do Folk on the Farm, which is a lovely festival.
Yeah.
I'm doing a house gig, actually. I'm doing three gigs in Anglesey, but this is the only... I used to play in Menai Bridge, which is on the island.
Yeah.
It used to be a great little club there, a pub. A chap used to put on the bridge, but unfortunately the pub just changed hands. And it's getting hard these days. So many people, I mean, the people who run this, it's fantastic what they do, but it's a lot of hard work for them. They don't get any payment for it. The pub lets them use the room, which is fantastic, but it's just all about the community. And I'm cutting back on gigs, not doing so many gigs. I want to concentrate on getting my album out. So, yeah.
So what kind of songs do you like to write nowadays? You used to sing songs with the Christians.
Now I suppose they're more me writing about my life. But not always. I mean, the first album was called Chronicles of Modern Life, and it was dealing with, I don't know, being a 53-year-old can't run for buses like I used to, and, you know, it deals with when the boyfriend is brought home for the first time, the daughter, and he ain't good enough for you, so things like that. Now, I just, it's bits of everything.
So, did you enjoy Henry Priestman's gig?
Yes, it was really quite good, yeah. Gig, yeah.
Yeah, and you also played with him on your melodica.
Yeah, on Ghosts of the Thousand Fishermen, yeah.
Yeah, so the melodica is a sort of wind instrument with a keyboard.
Yeah.
And fantastic.
Right, let's get Graham. If we have Graham on, from all the way from Coventry. I'm from Hull, and this song is all about how the docks used to be rich, and, loads of ships coming in from abroad, and now it's sort of like a Chinese restaurant and a shopping arcade. And it's called The Ghost of a Thousand Fishermen. And the ghost of a thousand fishermen still drink down Hesel Road, where all night long they slack their stones, and the beer and the whiskey flow.
With Dave and Graham leaving us in limbo for the conclusion of their holiday experiences next week, we come to the end of this edition of Outlook. So from me, Nigel Hewin, and all the team here, it's goodbye for another week.